readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Can you believe it? It's March already. Could there be an end in sight for the harsh winter weather? Fingers crossed. But the world of books is always a great pastime when the great indoors beckon. Okay, we may have been a little frivolous lately. Tinseltown, Chick Lit. There are so many fascinating titles from the nonfiction world. In fact, if you remember, the number one book on the Amazon's list last year was nonfiction, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which we previewed last year. I think this week we'll get down to it. Trust me, you'll be amazingly entertained and riveted by these titles. Let's get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Genius Bobby Fischer's story is at once intriguing and tragic. In Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall, author Frank Brady chronicles the life of a man whose moves on the chessboard catapulted him to superstar status, and then played out as he devolved to the edge of madness. Brady, founding publisher of Chess Life magazine and a friend of Fischer's, has written an impressively researched biography that captures the remarkable arc of Bobby Fischer's life. When Fischer passed away in 2008, he left behind a confounding legacy. He began as a brilliant youngster, the Mozart of the chessboard, became the pride of American chess, then took a sharp turn, struggling with paranoia and mental illness. What motivated Fischer from such a young age, and what was the source of his remarkable intellect? How could a man so ambivalent about money and fame be so driven to succeed? What drew this man of Jewish descent to fulminate against the Jews, and how was it that a mind so famously disciplined could unravel so completely? Endgame draws upon hundreds of newly discovered documents and recordings, and numerous firsthand interviews with those who knew Fischer best. It paints, for the very first time, a complete picture of one of America's most enigmatic icons and reconciles Fischer's deeply contradictory legacy. The title is narrated by Ray Porter.
I was also a privileged official witness to his greatness. As a director of one of the first rated tournaments he played in as a child, I noted his steadfastness. As an arbiter, when he accomplished his historic 11-0 clean sweep at the 1963-1964 U.S. Championship Tournament, I stood by his board and observed his pride of accomplishment. And as the initial arbiter for Bobby when he was banned from traveling to Cuba for the Havana International Tournament and forced to play remotely by teletype entry, I spent hours alone with him in a closed room of the Marshall Chess Club, watching how his deep concentration was being compromised by fatigue. Although Endgame includes many incidents to which I was an eyewitness or in which I participated, the book is not in any way my memoir, and I've tried to remain invisible as much as possible. Through original research, analysis of documents and letters heretofore untapped, and hundreds of interviews over the years with people who knew or had a different perspective on Bobby, I've tried to capture the story of how he not only transformed himself, but also how, through a mysterious alchemy, he affected the image and status of chess in the minds of millions. And also how, unexpectedly, he saw his life become intertwined with the Cold War. Mainly as a result of Bobby's charisma and his widely publicized contretemps, his winning the world championship created more furor and attention and more awareness of the game by the general public than any other chess event in history. Bobby had an uneasy relationship with his extraordinary celebrity and ultimately grew to despise it. It was the public's intrusive gaze that caused him in later years to lead a determinedly reclusive, almost hermetic life. For this audiobook, I obtained access to portions of the KGB and FBI files on Bobby and his mother. The files not only provided me with insights, but also with specific information that corrects previously published versions of Bobby's life, including my own. In the course of researching Endgame, I came across an autobiographical essay, never published, that Bobby wrote when he was in his teens. Rough-hewn, for sure, but introspective nevertheless, which in many ways gave the story behind the story of his life at that time, especially how he viewed his ascent and how he was treated by various chess organizations. Information that I found in this essay helped to rectify existing misconceptions. In addition, I obtained access to the personal archives of his chess mentor, Jack Collins, and of Bobby's mother, Regina Fisher. These invaluable troves of letters, photos, and clippings have been an important source for this audiobook. Reading a letter from Bobby to Jack Collins, written decades ago, is almost like bringing Bobby back to life. Whether one admires or despises Bobby Fischer, and it's quite easy to do both simultaneously, as these pages will show, I hope that his story proves that while he was a deeply troubled soul, he was also a serious and great artist, one who had a passion to know. We may not, and perhaps should not, forgive Bobby Fischer's twisted political and anti-religious assaults, but we should never forget his sheer brilliance on the chessboard. After hearing this biography, I would suggest that the listener look to and study his games, the true testament to who he was, and his ultimate legacy.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers, I'm very pleased to welcome back my friend, Tom Schroeder. Tom is one of the foremost writers and editors of narrative nonfiction in the country. During my Miami Herald days, Tom was the editor of the Herald's Tropic magazine, then went on to be the editor of the Washington Post magazine from 2002 to 2009. Tom directed work that has been recognized with four Pulitzer Prizes, including the 2008 and 2010 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. This past October, Tom launched StorySurgeons.com, an editing and writing website. Tom is also an award-winning writer in his own right. I interviewed him last October while he was working under an almost impossible deadline to bring Fire on the Horizon to publication. The book is available now. Written with John Conrad, Fire on the Horizon is a harrowing minute-by-minute account of the fateful day, April 20th, 2010, when the half-billion-dollar oil rig Deepwater Horizon blew up in the Gulf of Mexico, taking with it 11 lives and leaving behind a swath of unprecedented natural destruction. The book takes an in-depth look at the life of the rig itself, from its construction in South Korea in the year 2000 to the improbable journey around the world to its disastrous end. And it chronicles the day-to-day lives of those on board, the struggles and the ambitions of those who call the rig home. It offers full-scale portraits of the Horizon's captain, its chief mate, its chief mechanic, and others. What emerges is a white-knuckled chronicle of engineering hubris at odds with the Earth itself, and an unusual manifestation of corporate greed and the unforgettable heroism of the men and women on board. Welcome, Tom. It's so great to have you with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, the book is now published and getting strong reviews. Sebastian Junger said it was, and I quote, "one of the best disaster books I've ever read. I tore through it like a novel, but with the queasy knowledge that the whole damn thing is true. A phenomenal feat of journalism." Wow.
Yeah, and they come in from him. That made my week, I'll tell you.
I bet. We spoke last October. You shared your incredibly tight schedule. Can you share your writing and research experience with our listeners? What was it like?
Well, I kind of am embarrassed to admit, but I guess like a lot of people, I knew nothing about offshore oil drilling. And I had this idea that there were these platforms that were kind of built on pylons that went all the way down to the bottom, and that these people just sort of sat out there doing nothing but drilling for God knows how long at a time. And I knew nothing about the people who did it. I knew nothing about the technology. I didn't even think about, how hard is it to try to drill a hole when you can't even start until you're a mile under the water? And so the process of me learning how all this happened, in fact, these aren't platforms that are sort of attached to the ground. Of course, a mile through the water is way too long for that. And what they are is sophisticated ships that can hover over one spot using this incredibly sophisticated computer-generated thrust. And these immense platforms that are like the size of two football fields put together, and multiple decks, and with something like a hotel and an office building that are hanging down from the main deck, and that these people, in this case, there are 127 people on board, and that they form this kind of community where it's almost like a band of brothers. They're out there for 3 weeks at a time. They learn to really depend on each other. They're proud of this unbelievable feat that they're doing. You're starting a mile below the ocean, and then you're drilling down another 18 or 20,000 feet. And you're doing it all at the end. Nobody can go down that far. A mile below the ocean is further even than a nuclear sub can go. So imagine the difficulty of starting there and trying to then drill down 18,000 feet through, all sorts of different conditions. And so I had to, it seems like every technique that they use is something that the lay people know nothing about. And so even when they're defining what they do, even when they sort of explain what they do, they're using vocabulary words that I never heard before. So every time they define something, I had to get 20 other definitions in order to understand the first definition.
So there's actually men and women who work on the rig.
Well, I mean, it used to be almost exclusively men. Now there are some women, and there was a woman who figured prominently. But it's still an incredibly male-dominated culture. And since the whole thing is in the Gulf and that draws mainly from the South, it is really a good old boy-dominated culture still. But then they have to have all these sailors, these trained sailors from maritime academies around the country, and these very highly educated engineers who do this incredible technology to do the drilling. And they're from all around the country. So there's and that's part of what I discovered and what I wrote about, is that there's this culture clash between, you know, anybody who lives north of I-10 and everybody else. And they have to learn how to get along and to make things work under these, you know, conditions where they're out in the middle of nowhere on this very, very tiny island, working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. It was like a moon launch, really. I mean, the technology and the difficulty was every bit as complex as landing something on the moon. And we understand intuitively that going out into space and landing something on the moon has inherent risk that you can't ever eliminate. But for some reason, we had this idea that you could drill down 3 miles below the surface of the ocean into these incredibly high pressure and incredibly explosive and flammable oil deposits that have been sitting there for 10 or 20 million years without any risk. I mean, we really came to believe in our own press clipping, so to speak, that our technology had become so great that basically this was not a risky enterprise. It's every bit as risky as going to the moon.
Do you feel that another drilling disaster is inevitable from all of the research and your time spent on this, learning about this?
Well, think about it. I mean, what happens if that, you know, we go every year we go without a disaster, and let's say we go 10 more years, and let's say we go 15 more years. Every hour spent out there basically costs $1 million. It costs $1 million per hour to drill, and they're drilling 24 hours a day. This is an incredibly expensive proposition. And everything they always have choices between spending more money and making it a little bit safer, or saving some money and making marginally less safe. So the longer they go without a disaster, the better the argument is for saving some money and taking a few shortcuts. And ultimately, at some point, they're going to take one shortcut too many, which is what happened in the case of the Deepwater Horizon, and there's going to be a disaster. I mean, I hate to say it, but it is just inevitable.
Oh. Well, your book has such a different take on the Gulf oil disaster. Can you share one or two stories about the captain or the crew that really affected you?
Well, in the book, we go all the way from, our idea was to kind of make this the history of the Deepwater Horizon, which at the time it was built in 2000, 2001, was the most technologically advanced industrial machine ever built. And at the time it cost $500 million to build. And it was built in Korea. And so we decided that what we were going to do was we were basically going to do the biography of the Deepwater Horizon from the moment it was first conceived and then constructed in the Hyundai Heavy Industry Shipyard in Ulsan, South Korea, until it burned and ultimately sank on April 21st. It was very dramatic.
11 people died, right?
Yeah, 11 people died. And the story of one of those people is a big part of the book, because he was on the crane and he was trying to get down when the explosion knocked him to the floor, and he was unconscious, at least, you know, possibly already dead, but possibly not. And the chief mate was trying to rescue him, and the crane operator was a big, big man. So at first he gets up to him and he like tries to carry him off, and he can't because he's too heavy. So he runs back to get help, and then he finally gets help. I mean, there's all sorts of chaos breaking loose. They lost power. They were trying to restore the power. They were trying to decide whether to, you know, separate from the well. And so he goes back and he gets help finally. And then he goes back, and right as they see him, right as they're getting close to him, this huge explosion blows a whole wall of fire between them and the guy. And they're like sitting there unable to get there, looking through the flames, trying to figure out, is there another way to go? And realizing that there isn't, they have to leave him and abandon him. That's when they go to the life rafts. Well, I think that in order for us to, you know, we're all right now, like it or not, dependent on oil. And it's really urgently important that we be less dependent on foreign oil. And so for the moment, at least, it looks like we're going to go ahead and try to develop our offshore resources. Well, if we're going to do that, we really need to understand better what it takes, how amazing it is what these people do, how much risk is inherent in it, and to understand it much better than we have. We just sort of tend to ignore it and let it go on without, you know, sort of figure, well, it's being taken care of. I think we're all obligated to know a little bit more about it. And that was really what we were trying to do with Fire on the Horizon.
And readers, Tom Schroeder has done an amazing job on this book. You need to pick it up. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Lynn.
Okay, I admit it. I'm a total liberal arts girl. The only math I excel at is lunch math. And yes, I'm darn good. Science? Ugh, gives me the shakes. I fought my way through Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. It took me forever. So, in browsing through the new releases, this title caught my eye. 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, The Most Intriguing Scientific Mysteries by Michael Brooks. Science? It always mystifies me. But you have to agree, science starts to get interesting when things don't make sense. Even today, there are experimental results that the most brilliant scientists can neither explain nor dismiss. In the past, similar anomalies have revolutionized our world. In the 16th century, a set of celestial irregularities led Copernicus to realize that the Earth goes around the Sun and not the reverse. In this new title, Michael Brooks meets 13 modern-day anomalies that may become tomorrow's breakthroughs. Is 96% of the universe missing? If no study has ever been able to definitively show that the placebo effect works, why has it become a pillar of medical science? Was the 1977 signal from outer space a transmission from aliens? Spanning fields from chemistry to cosmology, psychology to physics, Michael Brooks captures the excitement and controversy of the scientific unknown. And yes, you don't need to be a science geek to enjoy it. It's read by Matt Addis.
I am standing in the magnificent lobby of the Hotel Metropole in Brussels, watching three Nobel laureates struggle with the elevator. It's certainly not an easy elevator to deal with. It's an open mesh cage with a winch system that looks like something Isambard Kingdom Brunel might have built. When I first got into it 3 days ago, I felt like I was travelling back in time. But at least I got it to work. Embarrassed for the scientists, I look away for a moment and distract myself with the grandeur of my surroundings. The Metropole was built at the end of the 19th century and is almost ridiculously ornate. The walls are panelled with vast slabs of marble, the ceilings decorated in subtle but beautiful gold and sage green geometric patterns. The glittering crystal chandeliers radiate a warmth that makes me want to curl up and go to sleep beneath their light. In fact, there are glowing, comforting lights everywhere. Outside, in the Place de Bruxelles, the wind is blowing a bitter cold across the city. Faced with the bleak December beyond those revolving doors, I feel like I could stand here forever. The Nobel laureates are still struggling. No one else seems to have noticed their plight, and I'm wondering whether to walk across the lobby and offer help. When I had my long fight with the door, I discovered there's something about the shutter mechanism that defies logic. When you think it must be locked, it isn't. It needs a final pull. But it occurs to me that people who have attached Nobel Academy pins to their lapels ought to be able to work that out for themselves. I like to think of scientists as being on top of things, able to explain the world we live in, masters of their universe. But maybe that's just a comforting delusion. When I can tear myself away from the farce playing out in the elevator, I will be getting into a cab and leaving behind perhaps the most fascinating conference I have ever attended. Not because there was new scientific insight, quite the contrary. It was the fact that there was no insight, seemingly no way forward for these scientists that made the discussion so interesting. In science, being completely and utterly stuck can be a good thing. It often means a revolution is coming. The discussion at the conference was focused on string theory, the attempt to tie quantum theory together with Einstein's theory of relativity. The two are incompatible. We need to rework them to describe the universe properly, and string theory may be our best bet, or maybe not. I've spent the last 3 days listening to some of today's greatest minds discuss how we might combine relativity and quantum theory. And their conclusion was that, more than 3 decades after the birth of string theory, we still don't really know where to start. This was a Solvay physics conference, a meeting with the richest of histories. At the first Solvay conference in 1911, the world's first physics conference, the delegates debated what was to be made of the newly discovered phenomenon of radioactivity. Here in this hotel, Marie Curie, Hendrik Lorentz, and the young Albert Einstein debated how it was that radioactive materials could apparently defy the laws of conservation of energy and momentum. Radioactivity was an anomaly. It didn't make sense. The problem was eventually solved by the birth of quantum theory. At the 1927 Solvay conference, though, the strange nature of quantum theory caused its own problems, provoking Einstein and Niels Bohr, Lorentz and Erwin Schrödinger, Ernest Rutherford and John von Neumann to sit discussing these new laws of physics with the same degree of confusion as they had shown toward radioactivity. It was an extraordinary moment in the history of science. Quantum theory encapsulated the novel idea that some things in nature are entirely random, happen entirely without cause. This made no sense to Einstein or Bohr, and the pair spent their time outside the formal discussions, sparring over what it all meant. They had entirely different philosophical approaches to dealing with that mystery, however. To Bohr, it meant some things might be beyond the scope of science. To Einstein, it meant something was wrong with the theory. It was here, in this hotel, that Einstein made his famous remark that gold does not play dice. Bohr's reaction faces up to scientists' biggest frustration, that they don't get to set the rules. Einstein, he said, stop telling God what to do. Neither man lived to see a satisfactory solution to the enigma.
Another book on science? Elaine, what up? The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World by Edward Dolnick is the story of a band of men who lived in a world of dirt and disease, but pictured a universe that would run like a perfect machine. It's a meld of history and science, a group portrait of some of the greatest minds who ever lived as they wrestled with nature's most sweeping mysteries. But readers, what drew me to this book, you ask? Did it have gravitational pull? No, it was the narrator, my friend Alan Sklar, who's been a guest on the show. I'd listen to anything Alan narrates, and this book certainly informs you as it entertains. At the end of the 17th century, an age of religious wars, plague, and the Great Fire of London, when most people saw the world as falling apart, these early scientists saw a world of perfect order. They declared that, chaotic as it all looked, the universe was in fact as intricate and perfectly regulated as a clock. This was the tail end of Shakespeare's century, when the natural and the supernatural still twined around each other. Disease was a punishment ordained by God, astronomy had not yet broken free from astrology, and the sky was filled with omens. It was a time when little was known and everything was new. These brilliant, ambitious, curious men believed in angels, alchemy, and the devil, but they also believed the universe followed precise mathematical laws, a contradiction that tormented them and changed the course of history. The Clockwork Universe is fascinating, and it's a compelling story of the bewildered geniuses of the Royal Society, the men who made the modern world.
A stranger to the city, who happened to see the parade of eager, chattering men disappearing into Thomas Gresham's mansion, might have found himself at a loss. Who were these gentlemen in their powdered wigs, knee breeches, and linen cravats? It was too early in the day for a concert or a party, and this was hardly the setting for a bull baiting or a prize fight. With its shouting coachmen, reeking dunghills, and grit-choked air, London assaulted every sense. But these mysterious men seemed not to notice. Locals, then, for the giant metropolis left newcomers reeling. The men at Gresham's looked a bit like a theater crowd, and with the Puritans out of power and Oliver Cromwell's head on a pole in front of Westminster Hall, theaters had opened their doors again. But in that case, where were the women? Perhaps the imposing building on the fashionable street concealed a gentleman's gambling club, a high-class brothel. Even a peek through a coal-grimed window might not have helped much. Amid the bustle, one man seemed to be spilling powder onto the tabletop and arranging it into a pattern. The man standing next to him held something between his fingers, small and dark and twitching. The world would eventually learn the identity of these mysterious men. They called themselves natural philosophers, and they had banded together to sort out the workings of everything from pigeons to planets. They shared little but curiosity. At the center of the group stood tall, skeletally thin Robert Boyle, an aristocrat whose father was one of Britain's richest men. Boyle maintained three splendid private laboratories, one at each of his homes. Mild-mannered and unworldly, Boyle spent his days contemplating the mysteries of nature, the glories of God, and home remedies for an endless list of real and imaginary ills. If Boyle was around, Robert Hooke was sure to be nearby. Hooke was hunched and fidgety, low of stature and always very pale. But he was tireless and brilliant, and he could build anything. For the past 5 years, he had worked as Boyle's assistant, cobbling together equipment and designing experiments. Hooke was as bad-tempered and sharp-tongued as Boyle was genial. To propose an idea was to hear that Hooke had thought of it first. To challenge his claim was to make a lifelong enemy. But few questioned the magic in his hands. Hooke's latest coup was a glass vessel that could be pumped empty of air. What would happen if you put a candle inside? A mouse? A man? The small bird-like man was Hooke's closest friend, the ludicrously versatile Christopher Wren. Ideas tumbled from him like coins from a conjurer's fingertips. Posterity would know Wren as the most celebrated architect in English history, but he was renowned as an astronomer and a mathematician before he sketched his first building. Everything came easily to this charmed and charming creature. Early on, an admirer proclaimed Wren a miracle of youth, and he would live to 91 and scarcely pause for breath along the way. Wren built telescopes, microscopes, and barometers. He tinkered with designs for submarines. He built a transparent beehive to see what the bees were up to, and a writing gizmo for making copies with two pens connected by a wooden arm. He built St. Paul's Cathedral. The Royal Society of London for the Improvement of Natural Knowledge, the formal name of this grab-bag collection of geniuses, misfits, and eccentrics, was by most accounts the first official scientific organization in the world. In these early days, almost any scientific question one might ask inspired blank stares or passionate debate. Why does fire burn? How do mountains rise? Why do rocks fall? The men of the Royal Society were not the world's first scientists. Titans like Descartes, Kepler, and Galileo, among many others, had done monumental work long before. But to a great extent, those pioneering figures had been lone geniuses. With the rise of the Royal Society and allowing for the colossal exception of Isaac Newton, the story of early science would have more to do with collaboration than with solitary contemplation.
right, we're moving on. We're getting on point, so to speak. Back to the arts with Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet by Jennifer Homans. It's a groundbreaking work, the first cultural history of ballet ever written, and it is beautifully told. For more than 400 years, the art of ballet has been an elegant part of Western civilization. Its traditions serve as a record of our past. A ballerina dancing the Sleeping Beauty today is a link in a long chain of dancers, stretching back to 16th century Italy and France. Her graceful movements recall a lost world of courts, kings, and aristocracy, but her steps and gestures are also marked by dramatic changes in dance and culture that followed. Ballet has been shaped by the Renaissance and Classicism, the Enlightenment and Romanticism, Bolshevism, Modernism, and the Cold War. In this way, ballet is unique. It has no written texts. It's a storytelling art passed on from teacher to student. The steps are a living, breathing document of culture and tradition. And while ballet's language is shared by dancers everywhere, its artists have developed distinct national styles. French, Italian, Danish, Russian, English, and American traditions each have their own expression, often formed in response to political and societal upheavals. From ballet's origins in the Renaissance and the codification of its basic steps and positions, under Francis Louis XIV, himself an avid dancer, the art form wound its way through the courts of Europe, from Paris and Milan to Vienna and St. Petersburg. The Washington Post calls this title a delight to read, massively informed yet remarkably agile. Kristen Potter narrates.
We all knew that some part of her was still elsewhere, in a world far from ours. Everything about her was different. She wore heavy makeup, long false eyelashes, and sickly sweet perfumes. And I remember her bejeweled and dressed in a deep royal blue leotard with matching scarf, chiffon skirt, and pink tights that showed off her unusually long and still impressively muscular legs. Her movements, even when she wasn't dancing, were gracious and ornamented, elegantly conveyed in ways that we American teenagers could never quite replicate. There were others, too. Muriel Stewart, an English dancer who had performed with the legendary Anna Pavlova, Antonina Tumkovsky, and Hélène Dudin, who were both from Kiev and had emigrated to the States after the Second World War. Dudin's feet were crippled. It was rumored the Soviets had broken them. And perhaps most striking of all, Alexandra Danilova, who had fled Leningrad in 1924 with Balanchine. Danilova was like Dubrovska, a former imperial dancer inclined to pastel chiffons, spidery false eyelashes, and heavy perfume. She had been an orphan in Russia, but we never for a moment doubted her aristocratic pedigree. She coached us on carriage and comportment, not just in dance class, but also in life. No T-shirts, slumping, or street food, reminding us that our training and chosen profession set us apart. Dancers do not look like the rest. All of this seemed to me at once perfectly normal and extremely alien. Normal because we knew that these were the masters, and we understood that they had something important to convey. Besides, there was something about standing so straight, about the body working so beautifully, and about our dedication and intense desire to dance that did set us apart. We really were, or so we thought, an elect. But the whole thing was also alien. Nothing was ever really explained, and the teaching seemed offensively authoritarian. We were expected to imitate and absorb, and above all, to obey. Please to do was all the Russians could muster, and why was met with bemusement or flatly ignored. We were forbidden to study dance elsewhere, one of the few rules we blithely ignored. None of this sat well. We were children of the 1960s, and this insistence on authority, duty, and loyalty seemed outrageously old-fashioned and out of place. But I was too interested in what these Russians were doing to quit or go away. Finally, after years of study and watching, I realized our teachers were not just teaching steps or imparting technical knowledge. They were giving us their culture and their tradition. Why was not the point, and the steps were not just steps. They were living, breathing evidence of a lost, to us, past, of what their dances were like, but also of what they, as artists and people, believed in. Ballet, it seemed, was another world. I had queued with my mother to see the Bolshoi and the Kirov, stood squashed in standing room at the back of the Metropolitan Opera House to see American Ballet Theater and Baryshnikov, crowded into class to watch Rudolf Nureyev execute a ballet bar. And it was not just ballet. New York at the time was a dynamic center of dance, and we studied and saw everything. Martha Graham, Merce Cunningham, Paul Taylor, jazz, flamenco, tap, the small experimental troupes that performed in the city's studios and lofts. But to me, there was one overriding reason to dance, the New York City Ballet. These were the final years of Balanchine's path-breaking career, and the artistic and intellectual vitality of his company was electrifying. We knew that what he was doing was important, and we never for a moment questioned the primacy of ballet. It was not old or classical or dated. To the contrary, dance was more intensely alive and present than anything we knew or could imagine. It filled our lives.
Okay, I admit it. When I think about royalty at the moment, I'm thinking about Prince William's upcoming wedding to the lovely Kate. But here's a title from His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. In Harmony, A New Way of Looking at Our World, Charles shares his views on how our most pressing challenges, from climate change to poverty, are rooted in mankind's disharmony from nature, presenting a compelling case that the solution lies in our ability to regain a balance with the world around us. With its holistic approach, the book takes the discussion of sustainability and climate change in a new direction. Prince Charles shows how the solutions to problems like climate change lie not only in technology, but in our ability to change the way we view the modern world. For decades, the Prince of Wales has been talking to plants and studying a wide array of disciplines to understand every aspect of man's impact on the natural world. Now, for the first time, he speaks out about his years of research, presenting a look at how modern industrialization has led us to a state of disharmony with nature, created climate change, and pushed us to the brink of disaster. Charles, who narrates the book, also offers solutions for change, creating a new vision for our world, one that incorporates the traditional wisdom of our past with the modern science of our present to avert catastrophe. Let's listen.
So many appeared to think or were told that I was merely leaping from one subject to another, from architecture one minute to agriculture the next, as if I spent a morning saving the rainforest, then in the afternoon jumping to help young people start new businesses. What I've actually been trying to demonstrate is that all of these subjects are completely interrelated and that we have to look at the whole picture to understand the problems we face. For not only does it concern the way we treat the world around us, it is also to do with how we view ourselves. In all my efforts, I've tried to make it clear that all these subjects suffer the same problems because they have become detached from important basic principles. The principles that produce the active state of balance, which is just as vital to the health of the natural world as it is for human society. We call this active but balanced state harmony, and this book is dedicated to explaining how harmony works. It is a book in which I hope to share the results of much thought, observation, and reflection over the past 30 or 40 years. I want to show what I've gained and achieved from studying the essential principles of harmony, how they work in nature, and how, if we ignore or flout them, the Earth's precious life support systems start to wobble and eventually may collapse. In some cases, they have already fallen into a perilous state. That is why our journey begins with a look at just what we are doing to our life-giving Earth after some 2.5 centuries of intensive industrialization. We all hope for solutions, and that is why I want to end this journey by offering what might turn out to be a few of them. But the solutions must be understood in their proper context. I know from experience that if any solution is not deeply rooted in the right principles, it will be of no use in the long term. In fact, quite the contrary, it will tend to compound the problems we already have. That is why I also want to put our present situation in its true historical context. We have to realize that we are traveling on the wrong road, but we need to understand why. It is very strange that we carry on behaving as we do. If we were on a walk in a forest and found ourselves on the wrong path, then the last thing we would do is carry on walking in the wrong direction. We would instead retrace our steps, go back to where we took the wrong turn, and follow the right path. This is why I feel it is so important to offer not just an overview of our present situation and not just a list of the solutions. I certainly want the world to wake up to the fact that we are traveling in a very dangerous direction, but it is crucial that we retrace how this has come to be. Otherwise, we will not head onto a better path in the future.
Liar's Poker was an incredible bestseller. So many people read it and talked about it. Now, Michael Lewis turns his lens on the 1980s, an outrageous and turbulent era in the financial market, not only on Wall Street, but around the world. In this new title, The Money Culture, Lewis, as a trainee at Salomon Brothers in New York, as an investment banker and later a financial journalist, was uniquely positioned to chronicle the ambition and folly that fueled the decade. In these often hilarious true tales, we meet the colorful movers and shakers who commanded the headlines and rewrote the rules. Whether he is analyzing the unsavory details of the RJR Nabisco takeover or skewering American Express, Lewis brings to task a wicked pen and a triumphant sense of humor. Alexander Sendise does a good job with the narration. Let's listen.
The elite graduates of Tokyo University were slow to forego the safety and discomfort of Japanese corporations for the high drama of American investment banks, but they did. And before long, a style of capitalism had become one of America's leading cultural exports. It had all begun with seemingly dry and boring changes in technology, financial regulation, and levels of debt in America, but it ended with a revolution in everyday commercial behavior. The pieces collected in this book are mainly set in and around the new money culture. They all relate, in one way or another, to the marvelous commercial madness of the 1980s. I've ordered them geographically, with a section each on America, Europe, and Japan. I won't pretend they were written with the intention of hurting them between hardcovers, but I don't intend to apologize for them either. After all, this is how I make my living these days. In 1985, the average income of the 10 best-paid people on Wall Street rose from $29 million to $51 million, and everyone involved traded in his gold American Express card for platinum. One night early that year, Stephen Joseph, a partner of the now bankrupt Drexel Burnham, made what seemed to be a routine business trip to Minnesota. The only unusual thing about it was that he visited his client in his home and stayed late for drinks. In the course of the evening, Joseph happened to mention how much he expected to be paid. The number made an impression on the client's 7-year-old son, who was eavesdropping on the staircase. 2 days later, the boy handed his father an essay he had prepared for school. It was called What I Want to Be When I Grow Up, and almost perfectly captured the mood of the day. I want to be an investment banker. If you had 10,000 shares, I sell them for you. I make a lot of money. I will like my job very, very much. I will help people. I will be a millionaire. I will have a big house. It will be fun for me. While those words were being written, I was interviewing for jobs on Wall Street. I eventually landed at Salomon Brothers, where I occasionally help people, but more often help myself. In my spare time, I wrote. Several of the pieces included here were written in the evenings after a day spent in a training program in New York or on a trading floor in London. A daytime job was an enormous and perhaps unfair advantage for a writer. It enabled me to watch people when they didn't know they were being watched, and disabused me of any illusions I might have had about Wall Street or its leaders, who were my bosses. In my defense, I can only say that my bosses knew what I was doing all along. One even took it upon himself to read my pieces before they appeared in print. There was one exception. After the stock market crash of October 1987, I surreptitiously published an article entitled When Bad Things Happen to Rich People. I used a female pseudonym, Diana Bleeker, mainly because I didn't want to be fired. I assumed that the rampant chauvinism of the Solomon Brothers traders would blind them to the possibility that a man might hide behind the name of a woman. I admit that while it was all very cowardly, I thought it was all very clever, as well as pleasing to my mother, since Diane Bleeker was the first two parts of her maiden name. It would have been even more clever and pleasing if I had spelled it correctly, and if the article, when it appeared, had not announced beneath the byline, "Diana Bleeker is a pseudonym." Anyway, the piece contained a paragraph or two of criticism of Solomon's chairman and CEO, John Goodfriend, as well as a few lines of description that could have come only from someone who had seen the Solomon Brothers trading floor. Skepticism about one's bosses, however well earned, is not universally appreciated, even in the upside-down world of an American investment bank. The day the article appeared, it was copied and distributed on our trading floor. Before long, I had several calls from traders who wanted to know if Diana Bleeker was me. Then something happened that I never expected. Instead of being angry or upset, John Goodfriend, give the man credit, was amused. He thought Diana Bleeker was funny. He thought she was so funny that he rose during a lunchtime meeting of Solomon's 109 managing directors and read aloud from her piece. Apparently, they didn't all find her equally amusing. A couple of days later, the managing director responsible for me flew the red eye from New York to London. In itself, this wasn't unusual. He'd take the overnight flight every few months to check on us and maybe do a bit of shopping, but normally he'd nap in his hotel room for a couple of hours before he visited the office. This time, he came without the benefit of sleep. I recall that he looked as if he were running on amphetamines as he stormed through the office door. The man was troubled. That made two of us. He came straight to my desk, also unusual as protocol demanded he check in with the head of the office before hobnobbing with us grunts. He smiled his most disarming smile, and he said, "I would just like to know one thing. Did you write that article?"
Readers, I have a 21-year-old son, and when I saw this title, I knew I had to preview this book. Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World by Jane McGonigal looks at today's society and finds that games are fulfilling real human needs in ways that reality is not. Hundreds of millions of people globally, 174 million in the United States alone, regularly inhabit game worlds because they provide the rewards, stimulating challenges, and epic victories so often lacking in the real world. Instead of futile hand-wringing about this exodus from reality, world-renowned game designer Jane McGonigal argues that we need to figure out how to make the real world, our homes, our businesses, and our communities engage us in the way that games do. Drawing on positive psychology and cognitive science, McGonigal reveals how game designers have hit on core truths about what makes us happy, from social connection to having satisfying work to do. Game designers intuitively understand how to optimize human experience. Reality is Broken shows that games can teach us essential lessons about mass collaboration, creating emotional incentives, and increasing engagement that will be relevant to everyone. The book is narrated by Julia Whelan.
They're the young adults in China who have spent so much play money, or QQ coins, on magical swords and other powerful game objects that the People's Bank of China intervened to prevent the devaluation of the yuan, China's real-world currency. Most of all, they're the kids and teenagers worldwide who would rather spend hours in front of just about any computer game or video game than do anything else. These gamers aren't rejecting reality entirely. They have jobs, goals, schoolwork, families, commitments, and real lives that they care about. But as they devote more and more of their free time to game worlds, the real world increasingly feels like it's missing something. Gamers want to know, where in the real world is that gamer sense of being fully alive, focused, and engaged in every moment? Where is the gamer feeling of power, heroic purpose, and community? Where are the bursts of exhilarating and creative game accomplishment? Where is the heart-expanding thrill of success and team victory? While gamers may experience these pleasures occasionally in their real lives, They experience them almost constantly when they're playing their favorite games. The real world just doesn't offer up as easily the carefully designed pleasures, the thrilling challenges, and the powerful social bonding afforded by virtual environments. Reality doesn't motivate us as effectively. Reality isn't engineered to maximize our potential. Reality wasn't designed from the bottom up to make us happy. And so, there is a growing perception in the gaming community: reality, compared to games, is broken. In fact, it is more than a perception. It's a phenomenon. Economist Edward Castronova calls it a mass exodus to game spaces, and you can see it already happening in the numbers. Hundreds of millions of people worldwide are opting out of reality for larger and larger chunks of time. In the United States alone, there are 183 million active gamers, individuals who, in surveys, report that they play computer or video games regularly, on average 13 hours a week. Globally, the online gamer community, including console, PC, and mobile phone gaming, counts more than 4 million gamers in the Middle East, 10 million in Russia, 105 million in India, 10 million in Vietnam, 10 million in Mexico, 13 million in Central and South America, 15 million in Australia, 17 million in South Korea, 100 million in Europe, and 200 million in China. Although a typical gamer plays for just an hour or two a day, there are now more than 6 million people in China who spend at least 22 hours a week gaming, the equivalent of a part-time job. More than 10 million hardcore gamers in the United Kingdom, France, and Germany spend at least 20 hours a week playing. And at the leading edge of this growth curve, more than 5 million extreme gamers in the United States play on average 45 hours a week. With all of this play, we have turned digital games for our computers, for our mobile phones, and for our home entertainment systems into what is expected to be a $68 billion industry annually by the year 2012. And we are creating a massive virtual silo of cognitive effort, emotional energy, and collective attention lavished on game worlds instead of on the real world. The ever-skyrocketing amounts of time and money spent on games are being observed with alarm by some, concerned parents, teachers, and politicians, and eagerness by others, the many technology industries that expect to profit greatly from the game boom. Meanwhile, they are met with bewilderment and disdain by more than a few non-gamers, who still make up nearly half of the U.S. population, although their numbers are rapidly decreasing. Many of them deem gaming a clear waste of time. As we make these value judgments, hold moral debates over the addictive quality of games, and simultaneously rush to achieve massive industry expansion,
readers, when I'm in a bookstore, the nonfiction shelves are not usually my first destination, but I hope today's show has changed your mind a little. Check out the show website at www.bookreportradio.com. In the archived shows, you'll find so many new and notable titles, definitely worth a visit when you're thinking about what to read next. And talking about what you'd like to hear next, drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com. Please make note of this. I'd love to hear from you. This is Elaine Charles, and I'll see you in 1 week for the next chapter of The Book Report.